This year, I am focused on saving and investing, but I still want to do things like travel. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending, which means you could end up with a free flight or maybe a better hotel room.
So what could future you do with smarter financial decisions? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Eating processed food for every meal isn't healthy for people or for dogs. We all know that. And kibble is subject to multiple rounds of high heat processing, making it an ultra processed food. The Farmer's Dog is real, fresh, healthy food with whole meat and veggies gently cooked in human-grade kitchens to preserve their nutritional value. My dog, Barnaby, loves the Farmer's Dog. When he sees me pulling one of those packets out, he comes running. It's personalized, vet-developed, and it has recipes for as little as $2 a day. Meals arrive in pre-portioned, ready-to-serve packs, and they're conveniently delivered on whatever schedule works for me.
Get 50% off your first box of fresh, healthy food at thefarmersdog.com/happier. That's 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/happier.
Hello and welcome to Happier, a podcast that gives you ideas about how to be happier. This week, we'll talk about why taking personality quizzes can boost happiness and also how to address book club conflicts. I'm Gretchen Rubin, a writer who studies happiness, good habits, and human nature. I'm in New York City, and with me is my sister, Elizabeth Kraft. And Elizabeth, I wish I could be in a book club with you.
Well, I know you have several, Gretchen. I could join if I were in New York.
Yes, yes, you could join.
That's me, Elizabeth Kraft, a TV writer and producer living in LA. And Gretchen, I got to tell you, I'm loving our Instagram project,
yes.
Our January Instagram habit that we have every day of posting a picture of something that makes us happier or helps us continue with our good habits.
Yes. Yeah. And we're using the hashtag #happier2017. So we're doing it every day and we love to see what everybody else is posting. When this is all over with, we're going to do maybe a deep dive into what we're seeing on Instagram. And so join us. You can see what we're doing and post your own pictures using the hashtag #happier2017 and tag us. I'm at Gretchen Rubin and Elizabeth is at Liz Kraft. And so it's so fun to see what people are doing. That's great. Oh, and another thing we'd love for listeners to join in is for our very, very special episode 100. We're going to answer questions from listeners, and it doesn't have to be about happiness or good habits or anything like that. It can be about any random question for us that you want. If you want to ask us, why don't we ever have our parents on the podcast? We will be happy to answer that question, which we get fairly often. We will answer it. And anything else that people have to ask. So it's been fun to see what people are sending us. So keep them coming.
Yes.
So Elizabeth, this week our Try This at Home tip was suggested by our listener, Katie, to take personality quizzes.
Yes, Katie wrote, in episode 92 with Manoush, you discussed the importance of knowing your type on Gretchen's Four Tendencies framework. I agree that the Four Tendencies quiz is a great resource to know yourself and others better. Your discussion got me thinking about other quizzes that people can use to help know themselves better. For example, the Myers-Briggs test, the Enneagram test, the Five Love Languages test, which you and I did an episode about. These are just a few resources that have been very valuable to me. Learning about my types on these tests is a huge happiness boost for me for several reasons. One, when I read about a specific trait my type might have, it makes me feel understood because I know there must be others who think like I do. Two, sometimes a test tells me something about myself that I think I knew unconsciously, but I had never been able to put into words. Three, different tests can yield similar results. It's interesting to see what aspects of your personality remain constant no matter what. For example, on the Myers-Briggs test, I am an ISFP. On the Enneagram test, I am a 4. If you read an overview of both of these types, they provide similar insights into my personality.
Well, and I think Katie's exactly right. And she does a great job of sort of summarizing what I think are the benefits of using these kind of frameworks, which is first, you have this feeling of like, oh, I'm not alone. I thought this was just like my own private, you know, problem or quirk. And then you realize, no, this is a thing that many people experience. And also a lot of times by shining a spotlight on a certain characteristic, it allows you to understand yourself better. You're like, oh, yeah, I never thought about how I did that. But now that somebody puts words to it or talks about how it's a pattern of behavior, I can understand myself better, because instead of just feeling like I'm like this loose collection of sort of semi-disorganized behavior, I see how it all, like how it's all in this pattern. So I think Katie is exactly right that these kind of personality frameworks can be really helpful.
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned in episode 80, we discussed the five love languages. And I think for both of us, identifying both of us are words of affirmation as our love language and identifying what Adam and Jamie's love languages are helped us sort of understand our marriage better and maybe even make our marriage a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I will say, you know, because of the four tendencies framework, you know, I'm constantly obsessively talking about it. And some people really don't like the ideas of these frameworks, and they make good points. And one is that you don't want to limit your sense of potential, that some people fear that if you say like, well, I'm a this, that somehow you'll feel like you can't change, you can't grow, that you don't have any more potential. Like a phrase I've sometimes heard is, if you define me, you can find me. And I think it's a very important thing to remember that these are meant to illuminate. They're meant to be helpful and to point like ways of possible change or like, as you were saying, how you might manage conflict with other people or have greater insight into other people because you understand how you might be like them or might be different. But you don't want to get so locked into it that you're like, oh, well, I'm an obliger, so of course you can't expect me to do that. Or, well, you know, on the Enneagram, I'm a seven, so, you know, you can't expect me to do X, Y, Z. You want to use it as a tool, not as like a loophole to let yourself off the hook.
Yeah, it's just meant to, it's the know yourself better thing. It's the better you know yourself, the more you can evolve.
Yes, exactly.
So, Gretchen, what do you think? I know you have studied all of the different personality tests. What do you think are some really useful ones that people could look to?
Well, one is a really interesting one is the Newcastle Personality Assessor, and it tells you where you fit along the big five personality dimensions. And right now, the big five factors is a framework of personality that I think is considered like one of the best models of personality. There's a lot of science behind it. A lot of people really support it as like, if you're going to really try to sum up people, the big five is the way to go. And there's a terrific book by Daniel Nettle called Personality, What Makes You the Way You Are. And you can take a quick quiz there that will tell you where you fall on the big five. The big five are openness to experience, which is how much intellectual curiosity you have, your creativity, your preference for novelty and variety. Conscientiousness, which is your tendency to be organized and dependable, to show self-discipline, to act dutifully, to aim for achievement, and to prefer planning over spontaneity. Now, two of these are extroversion and neuroticism, and these in here, like the words don't mean exactly what you might think they mean from other ways you've heard them used. Extroversion is your sort of tendency to feel positive emotion, assertiveness, sociability, and the tendency to seek stimulation in the company of others, talkativeness, that kind of extroversion. Neuroticism is really the tendency to experience negative emotions easily. So it's like, how easily do you feel angry, anxious, depressed, vulnerable, and like, how long do you stay in those emotions? And also it has to do with emotional stability and impulse control. And then finally, agreeableness. And that's the tendency to be compassionate and cooperative rather than suspicious and antagonistic. How trusting and helpful you are. How are you sort of well-tempered? So those are the big five. And when you take this personality assessor in the book Personality, it will give you a score. And there's also an online version you can take. And in the show notes, for happiercast.com/99. I'll put in links to the quizzes, links to the book, so everybody can go and do these themselves. And I got to say, Elizabeth, a few years ago, I took the written version of this and I found out what I was.
And did you think it was accurate?
I did think it was accurate. I do think it was accurate. I will leave it at that. And so for extroversion, I got low medium. For neuroticism, I got low medium. So I think that's a person who's sort of like, not so emotional, probably, which I think is true. Mm-hmm. For conscientiousness, I got high, which I would have thought I would get. Openness, I got high, which was interesting to me. And here's something that was very interesting. For agreeableness, there's a different score for men and women. Mm. And for agreeableness, for a woman, I score low. If I were a man, my score would have been more, would have been higher. It would have been considered low medium.
Oh,
so it's
women
like
women are supposed to be more agreeable, I guess.
Well, I guess they, it's not that they're supposed to be more agreeable, but they tend to score higher on agreeableness. And I have to say, Elizabeth, one of the things I've noticed about myself is I'm not that agreeable.
Oh.
So I did feel like this was pretty accurate.
Oh, that's interesting.
You're higher on agreeableness than I am for sure.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is I didn't get any highs.
Mm. Interesting.
I got all medium or high medium. The lowest score I got, interestingly, was extroversion, which I think a lot of people think I am an extrovert. But according to their definition, I'm low on that. So I did, the highest scores I got were in agreeableness and openness,
yeah,
but I still wasn't high.
Ah, that's so interesting. So did you feel like looking at it all together, except for the one on extroversion where you were surprised you didn't score higher, do you think it was a pretty good picture of yourself?
Yeah, I think it was a good picture. And even the extroversion, I could see that, you know, maybe my impression of myself isn't exactly matching what I am. So that was really interesting.
Well, and I have to say, for me, one of the talking about know yourself better and how these can help, it's like realizing that I got a low score in agreeableness, because I took this a couple years ago. It's made me make more of an effort to be agreeable because I realize it's kind of an Achilles heel for me. Like, mm-hmm. I can be brusque. I can be too pushy. I can forget my courtesy. And knowing, kind of seeing a low, you're like, that's not so good. Like, you want to be.
Yeah.
But and it also, I was like, well, it's also kind of true, you know. And there's kind of good parts of being low agreeableness. I think it makes some things easier. But anyway, it gave me a lot of food for thought. To think
yes.
about what were the pros and cons of not scoring very high on agreeableness. Now, Lisa, there's also the Enneagram. Do you know about the Enneagram, right?
I do know about the Enneagram. Tell everyone about it, because it's something even as a writer I've used in developing characters, sort of deciding where they are on the Enneagram.
So you've actually used the Enneagram as you're building characters in your writing?
Yes.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, the Enneagram is a personality framework that divides everybody into 9 categories, and its origins are somewhat disputed. But, you know, what I think with a lot of these frameworks is that a lot of the value of it comes from just whether you find it helpful, whether you find it illuminating. And so, you know, some are more scientifically validated than others. And like the 5 love languages, which I think you and I and a lot of people find incredibly helpful, that was just purely observational. That was just one guy saying, as a marriage counselor, this is what I've seen. And it absolutely rings true for people. So again, the Enneagram, it's like, I don't know what the science is, but a lot of people find it helpful.
Okay, so Gretchen, in the Enneagram, there are 9 personality types. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what they are. There's the reformer, the helper, the achiever, the individualist, the investigator, the loyalist, the enthusiast, the challenger, and the peacemaker.
Mm, yeah. I took an online Enneagram test. And again, I'll put a link in the show notes, happiercast.com/99. And it gave me 3 results, Elizabeth, I have to say. It gave me reformer, which said I was realistic, conscientious, principled. Also, number 3, achiever, which is energetic, optimistic, goal-oriented. And 5, investigator, which is need knowledge, introverted, curious, analytical, insightful. So that sounds good.
Interesting. That's all good.
Yeah. So what did you get?
So where you and I cross in a Venn diagram of our personalities are number 3, the achiever, the energetic, optimistic, goal-oriented.
Yeah.
And then I also got number 6, the loyalist, which means I'm a security-oriented type.
Mm. Interesting. And so did you find that taking the Enneagram did help you sort of gain an insight, self-insight?
It does, yeah. I mean, I think always when you kind of can put a label to some of your tendencies, to use one of your words,
yeah,
it helps sort of go, oh, okay, I'm that way. I wonder if other people see me that way. And how might I be some of these other things? You know, like, how can I be more of a peacemaker?
Right.
If that's not my, you know, instinct or something like that.
The one thing I would say that, like, because I have my four tendencies framework. And again, if you want to take that, you can take it at happiercast.com/quiz. And it will tell you if you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, a rebel. But one of the things that I really think is valuable in my quiz, if I say so myself or in my framework, is that it's very narrow. It's very specific. And one of the things that I sometimes object to in these larger things, like the Enneagram, is it's sort of trying to explain too much about a person, whereas I feel like people are more mixed up. And yeah, it's like you're 1, 3, and 5. Okay, well, I'm 1, 3, and 5, but like I'm a little bit of this, I'm a little bit of that, and then there's these other things that don't fit in. What I like about my four tendencies, which is just about how a person responds to an expectation, it's like it's only explaining you to that degree. It's that it will tell you absolutely, but then how ambitious you are, how considerate you are, how introverted you are, how adventurous you are, all those other things can be mixed up in all different combinations, but it's only as to this one thing, all questioners will be the same. It's more targeted. It's interesting because then I think a lot of the frameworks are trying to be more, they're trying to be more comprehensive. And then I feel like, people don't fall into, I feel like those kinds of patterns aren't as crisp.
Yeah, because you can, it's like trying to be all things to all people in a sense.
Yeah. But I will say sometimes there are things that you're like, where you're like, oh my gosh, that's just so true. I remember with the Enneagram, I saw something that said one of the downsides of being a 5, which is the investigator one, is stinginess and retention. And you know, one of my 12 personal commandments is to spend out, because what is my problem? I am stingy and I am constantly have this problem with retention that I won't spend out. And so I was like, for that, I was like, it's so uncanny.
And that's why I think it's good for building characters and writing, is because you can go, well, if this character is like this, what might they also be like? And it helps you round out a sort of deeper, more complex picture.
Right. And then you see the positives, but also the negatives that might go with it, because if you need both to exactly as you said, have a three-dimensional character. Now for people who like love their quizzes, you can take a bazillion quizzes on the Authentic Happiness website. That's out of the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Program. And there's quizzes about general happiness, character strengths, optimism, grit, life satisfaction, like a million different ones, all on the larger subject of happiness and sort of subsets of that. And again, I'll put the link there for people who want to get into that. Really, there's just a multitude of quizzes that you could take.
Yeah. And Gretch, as we talked about, you have your own quiz, the Four Tendencies quiz. And I assume you will put a link to that in the show notes this episode.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and I'm working on my book about the Four Tendencies. And so I'm thinking a lot about how do you think about even the idea of a personality framework, and how much do you include, and how far do you reach in making generalizations? But I really do believe that there is value in finding these categories, because I mean, you and I both experienced this. Like, you see this sort of written down and then you just get insight from it. Even if you disagree with it, that sometimes gives you insight, because you're going to be like, that's just not true for me. Even that is valuable, because you're knowing yourself better by disagreeing with something that somebody might have said.
So let us know if you try this at home and whether you feel like taking personality quizzes helps you figure out how to be happier. You can get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, drop us an email at podcast@GretchenRubin.com, or go to happiercast.com/99 for contact info, images, links, and everything else related to this episode. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. LinkedIn has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive.
I know that when I've been hiring, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to find quality candidates. It's really hard to handle the process. Hiring is easy when you have lots of quality candidates, like with LinkedIn Jobs. It's so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Gretchen. That's linkedin.com/Gretchen to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. There are some stories from our mother's life that I love to hear about. I love hearing about how she played with a tin dollhouse when she was a girl. And just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for our families forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mother and mother figures for years to come. And it makes a wonderful keepsake book so you never, never lose these wonderful stories and memories.
Here's how it works. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick, like, what was your favorite toy as a little girl, or what was your first job? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. Long or short, it doesn't matter. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years, Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/happier. That's storyworth.com/happier to save $10 on your first purchase. Okay, Gretch, this week we have a happy to hack about emails that could be controversial. And, you know, emails is a hot button topic for people.
Yes. Yes, I have very strong feelings about this happiness hack, but I want to put it out there. So tell me if you agree with me. I will be very interested to hear what people say. And this has to do, this is what my hack is. My hack is, do not put many issues and questions in a single email, because I find that this can be overwhelming. And when you see the subject line, it's not clear what is actually contained in the email. And often, if more than one person is on the email, as it often is the case, then it's not clear, like, who's supposed to be answering, who is, if, are you going to reply all, are you going to go through and individually do it? And I think, in my experience, a lot of times I think people are like, well, I don't want to overwhelm you with a bunch of emails, and so I'm just going to put it all in an omnibus email and get it all out there, and so it's just sort of simple for you. So it's well-intentioned, but I think that it actually does not work at all.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that the most helpful thing is to have a subject line that is very clear about what this email is about so that you can go back and find it.
Yes.
And I know you, Gretch, I will say you practice what you preach on this. You send a separate email for every single item that we need to discuss, or, you know, what, like, you might send 5 emails in 30 seconds.
Well, do you find that annoying or do you find that helpful? Or both?
I find it helpful because then I can go back and search for if I need to find something like personality test, I can search for personality test as opposed to going, well, what email was that where Gretchen sent me a link to a personality test?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and also what I find is, like, I often use emails as sort of a to-do list, and I will leave an email in my inbox as a way to remind me to do something. And so if an email has like 5 things in it that I'm supposed to do or I'm supposed to review, then I might delete it too early because I'm like, oh, I've done that, and I forget that there's something in there that I haven't done. Or it doesn't serve that function. Whereas for me, if I see like 5 things that I need to do, like even if they're from the same person, then I can be like, oh, here's this one. I'll get rid of that one, but I still have these other 2 points that I need to get back to that person on. But I think, but the downside is you kind of look like a crazy person because, like you say, I will send an email like, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? So I don't know that everybody's going to agree with this.
Yeah, well, let us know. I'm curious if people think this is annoying or helpful. I think it's helpful.
Right. And here's something else I think that the research shows. If you're a person who puts your email into folders to make it easier to manage it that way, the research shows that that doesn't work, that it's actually slower to be sorting your emails into folders, and it's faster to just use search, which goes to your point, Elizabeth, that if you have a really descriptive subject line, then people can easily find things through search, which is much faster than like trying to sort things into different folders and then to go back to that folder. It turns out that that is actually not as efficient a way of organizing your emails.
Yeah, and I have to say, I didn't even know there was such a thing as email folders. So it's not something I'm going to be doing.
You haven't been wasting your time sorting your emails into like podcast to-do list folder.
No, I didn't even know that was an option.
Good. Well, you've been saving yourself a lot of time. So Let us know about this hack. I've learned a lot about how people feel about my email habits. I am using delay delivery. Thank you, people, for that.
And Gretch, I did that. I had an email to send over the weekend, and I said, you know, this isn't a weekend email, and I sent it Monday morning.
We're evolving, as you say.
Yes.
And now it's time for a listener question. And as a reminder, you can always leave us a voicemail question at 774-277-9336, which is 77HAPPY336, or drop us an email at podcast@GretchenRubin.com.
Yeah. And Gretchen, this week we actually kind of have like a double listener question. The first one comes appropriately from a questioner, Melanie. And then we got a similar question from Rachel. So we're going to read both of their questions and discuss.
Yes. So Melanie writes, my friends and I started a book club and have been meeting monthly to discuss the book. It's been a big happiness booster and has gotten us all reading more, which is great. The problem is that one of our friends insists on coming to the meetings when she hasn't read or even started the book of the month. It bothers those of us who took the time to read, come up with discussion questions, and plan the meeting. It's awkward to go through the questions while one person sits there silently, so we end up rushing through the book discussion and moving on to unrelated topics that everyone can speak to. We're all in our 20s and see each other frequently outside of the book club. We've sent emails before kindly asking for only those who have read to attend, but the conflict is still happening.
Then there's a question from Rachel. She says, I started a book club with friends when I moved to New York 2 years ago, and it has been a huge hit and happiness booster for myself and my friend group. It started with just a few friends who have all invited various friends of friends, and the group has grown a lot. We're only a few years out of college, so it seems like someone new is always moving to New York or away from New York. Because of this and our varying schedules, the group that comes to each book club meeting is never consistent. Sometimes we have 20 people and sometimes only 5. This leads to the main problem with the group. No one reads the book. We spend our meetings catching up, eating and drinking, and talking about our lives. I really love those monthly gatherings with friends, but sometimes I get frustrated that we have no system for discussing books or even choosing our next book. Only about 4 of us consistently read the book and help choose the next one, usually when we are all a little tipsy at the end of the night or through discussion on our Facebook group. I don't want to stop being a part of this book club, but I also know that I would really enjoy a book club that is more committed to reading and discussing books, at least for part of the meeting. I was wondering whether you have advice for how to make our current book club more literary or how to potentially start a second club. I know you're in 3, but I don't know how to start a second group without hurting the feelings of friends in the original group or giving the impression that I think they're not good enough.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, a lot of social politics around book groups.
Well, I think the first point to be made is that both Melanie and Rachel agree that getting together with friends has been a huge happiness booster. It's strengthened their relationships with people. It's helped them form new relationships with people, which is a thing that I write about a ton in the Happiness Project, which is that a great way to make friends is to join or start a group. So that being said, they've got these problems related to their group.
Yes. I had this, Gretchen, with a writer's group I had years ago when Sarah and I first moved to LA. We were in a writer's group, which was incredibly helpful to us in our career. But over the years, it sort of did devolve into just, you know, eating cheese and crackers and drinking wine, which goes to one theory I have is that if you don't have like snacks, you'll probably have a more focused discussion, but that's probably not popular.
Yeah, I mean, there is this idea that there's a social contract that everyone is going to read the book. And if people don't read the book, then somehow it feels like somehow things aren't happening the way they should be. And that bothers some people more than others.
Yeah, because that is the point of the group is to read the book.
Yeah.
So what can be done? I mean, you could send an email to everyone with a reminder that people are supposed to come prepared. Melanie has tried that and said it didn't work great for her. But Rachel could try that.
Yeah. And but in the end, one of the things is you can't change other people. You can't make someone read the book. And so another thing to think about is like, well, can you view their behavior differently? So it doesn't annoy you, you know, that like one person isn't reading the book and it doesn't become a drag on your friendship. And I remember in that mode in episode 52, Our try this at home was, what happens if you ignore this? Which was a question that I got from my friend Michael Melcher. And you could just ignore it. You could just say, like, well, she's not reading the book and we're just going to go about our business and she's going to sit there silently and we're going to discuss the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think in Melanie's case, you know, when it's just this one person, you can think, well, maybe Melanie just, she's got stuff going on and she just can't handle reading right now, but she still really has a need to connect with people. And so you can have empathy for whatever she might be going through and just think, well, she has her reasons for not reading the book. And I think what you just said is key, which is don't let it shorten your discussion about the book. If she wants to be there, maybe she's just enjoying listening to everybody else talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I, as mentioned, I'm in actually four reading groups.
Yes.
And in all my groups, the expectation is you should come even if you have not read the book. And one of the kid lit groups has a motto, and the motto of the book group is no guilt. And so people are there. Everybody's told never don't come because you haven't read the book. You should come anyway. And our thing is just like, well, we're not going to be giving you spoiler alerts. So you will get the end of it ruined if you come and you listen, but you're welcome to come. So part of it is just the expectation.
I'm curious, Gretch, in your groups, how much of the time percentage wise would you say is spent talking about the actual book?
Well, this is a point that both people raise that's an issue, which is it can be frustrating when you really want to have a targeted discussion and then other people keep just wanting to talk about other things. And it really differs from group to group, and it also differs book to book. Because some books, there's tons to talk about, and then others, maybe people are like, yeah, I really liked it, and they don't seem to want to talk about it that much. So it really varies. But usually there's people in groups, in all the groups, where somebody will really say, like, well, now it's time to talk about the book, or, you know, and then if people wander off, they'll bring it back. But we don't have, like, official discussion questions or anything like that, which I think could be great. If there was like maybe one person who's designated to kind of maybe prepare a little paragraph of information or have questions or something like that. None of my groups have ever done that, but I think it would be cool.
And I do think that would make the group more focused. Like when they say there's 20 people showing up, you know, if there was the idea that there might be some homework involved in the group, it might filter out people who weren't serious about wanting to read the book.
Well, and I also think I think sometimes people should get kicked out if they're just not interested in that when they're like here for the friends.
Have you kicked anyone out?
We have. Well, so in one of my kidlit groups, I mean, these are kidlit groups where people really honestly love children's literature and young adult literature on their own. They're not reading it with their kids. They're reading it because they love it. And there's a few questions that you can ask people to decide, like, do they really love, you know, kidlit? Like, how do you feel about Twilight? Like, you can love Twilight, you can hate Twilight. But if you don't have a passionate
opinion
of Twilight, then you probably don't belong in our group. But we had somebody who came in, who slipped in, and she was always trying to change the subject when we were talking about the books. And then one day she said, maybe we should change the focus of the book group. Like, we could read Works in Translation. And everybody just looked at her and said, you know what? We are not the group for you. If you think we should be reading Books in Translation, no. And she left. And there was no hard feelings because she knew.
That's amazing.
So maybe you say, we're going to start a splinter group. You know, maybe you cast it in some sort of humorous way. Like, oh, you know, now we're going to have the people who are like, you know, the real rule followers or, you know, or something like that. Because I think a lot of times people will understand that if you really want to have that happen and they aren't interested in that, that it's really just a group that has a completely different function.
Yeah, I mean, and I know Rachel's worried about hurting people's feelings, but I think as long as they're still in the first group, their feelings won't be hurt if you have a second group. And that second group probably should be small. And if it's small enough, it'll kind of also be under the radar. It doesn't, you know, you don't need to post a picture of your group meeting on Facebook every week.
Right. And like you say, if there's more homework involved, if it's a sense like these are the people who really want to like make a thing out of it, then it might be that people in the first group are like, well, I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, I think I've mentioned this before, but I thought this was a really good solution. Like if you want to have like a goal, kind of a mission for your book group, and so you want to have something that you're discussing, but people aren't reading the books. I heard about a book group. It was an all guys book group where they read profiles from The New Yorker. So these were beautifully written, like famous pieces about fascinating people by really, really established authors. So it was really time well spent, but they could just get them off the internet and they were like 4,000 words long. And so people did a much better job of actually reading them, even if they wouldn't have necessarily read a whole book. So you could have a book group that talks about something other than a whole book if you find that people are not doing that. Or I've heard of people with the Happiness Project, they'll read one chapter a month for a year.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So then people aren't reading the whole book. They're reading one chapter and then they talk. That's really just them talking about themselves and like how they want more energy or what can they do to, you know, increase their friendships or whatever. But again, it's like you don't have to, if people aren't able to read a whole book for whatever reason, then you could change the mission of the group.
Yes. And it seems like, you know, groups do change and evolve. And that is both a good thing and a bad thing about groups, I would say.
Yes.
Is that they never stay the same.
Yeah, that's a very good point, especially when you're younger and everybody's moving and getting together with people and splitting up and getting new jobs and going back to grad school. Like there's a lot of transitions. So a group can be a wonderful way to like have that basis in your life, a friendship, but it might be hard to keep everybody towing the line.
Yes. Because I do think there is an aspect of many of us where we like the idea of being in a book group because we like the idea that we're reading, but we don't actually want to read.
But the thing about obligers is if you're an obliger, be in a book group and then you'll read the book.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If your group is very explicit, like we really do want you to read the book. It's not like Gretchen's book groups where you're off the hook. It's like we really want you to read the book and that's our expectation. That could be great for obligers because then maybe they would get more reading done. So anyway, these are very complex. Like now that you start thinking about book groups, it's like, oh, there's a lot. Like you say, there's like a lot of social questions bound up in them.
But I wish Melanie and Rachel good luck with their book groups. I want them to stick with them.
Yes.
And I want Rachel to do her spinoff book group.
Happy reading, guys.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help children really understand and master topics in a fun way with positive feedback. I mean, when Eleanor was young, she really, really struggled with math, and a program like IXL would have really helped her to get ahead, to keep up, study for a test. It's a great tool.
Don't miss out. One in four students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Happier listeners get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/happier. Visit IXL.com/happier to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
So listen, I'm intrigued. What is this recycled demerit of which you speak?
All right, Gretchen. A while back, I gave myself a happiness demerit related to my eye ailments called blepharitis. Not sure how to pronounce that. I always call it blepharitis, but that's not how it's spelled. And essentially, I need to scrub my eyelids with like a special scrub in order to keep them from getting sort of the pores from getting blocked up and causing this condition called blepharitis. And I had that as a happiness demerit. We talked about it. I got it under control and now it's back with a vengeance.
Oh, well, Elizabeth, you always call me a happiness bully, but I'm questioning my usefulness as a happiness bully if I wasn't able to like persuade you to stick to your blepharitis routine.
Well, I think the bullying, it has to continue as a problem, you know, and so that's why I'm bringing it up, so that you will bully me and then I will go back to doing my daily or even twice daily routine. And you had a good suggestion back then, which I should go back to, which is putting my little scrub pads next to the coffee maker with the idea that I have to do it before I make coffee, because the first thing I do in the morning is make coffee. So I think I'm going to go back to that. And that should help.
Now, is this a chronic condition then? Because at the time, I remember thinking that it was like if you could get it cleared up, then it would be behind you. But is this something that it turns out you're going to have to just be on top of forever?
Apparently. And I think I didn't realize that. So that's part of why I fell off my routine. I was like, okay, well, that's better now. And I just forgot about it. And now it's back. And I kind of sensed it was coming back and I didn't, you know, get on top of it. So anyway, more than anyone wants to hear about my eyelids, but I am going to get back on top of this. And, you know, you can, maybe you can ask me in an update in a few weeks of how it's doing so that I feel as the obliger, like I need to answer to you.
I'm going to hold you accountable to it.
Now, how about you, Gretch? What's your gold star?
Well, mine is also related to, I would say, facial cleanliness. So that's the theme of our demerits and gold stars.
Oh, good.
I want to give a gold star to my daughter, Eliza, because she really got on my case about nightly washing of my face, because I was basically just sort of splashing water on my face and like wiping it off with a towel and, you know, being like, well, that's it. And she was just like appalled, you know, like, you call that washing your face? I still see mascara. Oh, my God. You know? And so I was really like, you know, she's right. I'm not really washing my face appropriately. And so and I did like the obvious thing, which is I got some face soap that I liked the smell of that was in a pump so I could just pump it out, so make it as easy as possible. And just knowing that she was sort of paying attention, I was like, I need, she's right, I need to do this. And so it like takes an extra 3 minutes and I'm doing a much better job of cleaning my face. So gold star.
Gold star. And Gretchen, I have to ask, what is the, what are you using on your face?
Yeah. Oh, I'm using Cetaphil. The Cetaphil facial cleanser. Yeah.
That's great stuff. Easily gotten at any drugstore.
Any drugstore, yes. That makes it all easy. And that is it for this episode of Happier. Remember to try this at home. Take some personality quizzes. Tell us which ones you tried and if they did give you helpful insight into yourself.
Thank you to our producer, Kristen Meinzer. Also thanks to Andy Bowers and Laura Mayer of Panoply. Get in touch. Gretchen's on Twitter at Gretchen Rubin and I'm at Elizabeth Kraft. Our email address is podcast@GretchenRubin.com.
Now, as we always say, if you like this show, it really helps us if you tell a friend and if you subscribe to us on iTunes. But here's something else that you can do. You can help someone else figure out how to listen to a podcast. Because the fact is, once you know how to do it, you realize how incredibly easy it is to subscribe to a podcast and listen to a podcast. But for people who have never done it, it can feel very daunting. Like they don't know what to do and they don't, you know what buttons to push, etc. So if there's somebody who's got a podcast that you think that they would love, grab their phone and just show them how to subscribe, because it's wonderful free content for them. So you can do, you can give yourself a little gold star by showing them how to subscribe to a podcast.
Until next week, I'm Elizabeth Kraft.
And I'm Gretchen Rubin. Thanks for joining us. Onward and upward.
Gretch, I know from my own experience that baby making is not always simple. There is a lack of knowledge surrounding how to get pregnant. And when you want to conceive, there can be a lack of understanding and resources. Frida Fertility is the only one-stop shop that makes it easier to make a baby with a set of solutions for everything from reproductive health to ovulation tracking to conception aid.
Frida is simplifying the journey to parenthood with products that help you go from trying to making a baby. Frida products are innovative, easy to use, and accessible, from ovulation prediction to at-home insemination kits. This is baby making simplified. Find Frida Fertility on Amazon, at Target, and select CVS stores near you. That's Frida Fertility, F-R-I-D-A, Frida Fertility.